The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Reports Weekly Cyber Report, sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vaga Maradian. We recently spoke with Vern Boyle, the Vice President for Advanced Programs at the Emerging Capabilities Division of Northrop Grumman Mission Systems, our sponsor. We spoke before the revelation of Russia's massive cyber attacks on the U.S. government and industry. Here's our conversation. Vern, thanks so very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Your focus is on the breadth of technologies vital for cyber, and a focus area of that is artificial intelligence. You also are involved in the company's transformational computing enterprise that includes quantum computing, which is another kind of critical future enabling technology. But I want to focus a little bit on artificial intelligence, and it's such a key discriminator that it's become a bit of a buzzword over the past decade or so, right? I mean, it's like, hey, would you like some AI with your fries? Even though it is a capability with national military significance, as well as national sort of economic, you know, it's going to affect every element of life. There are still folks who don't fully understand what AI is and what AI isn't. Give us a sense for what AI is, where it's really useful, and where it's actually somewhat maybe not as useful, or differences that people should wrap their minds around.
Yeah, sure. So there are a variety of textbook definitions that we could recite. The way I like to think about it in its simplest form is AI is about replacing people with machines. And the expectation for AI is that those machines will have some ability to reason and make decisions just like people do. And there are a lot of underlying elements that make that possible, a lot of different mathematical principles, but at its highest level, that's what it's really about. Some people drop back to simple machine learning, which is really a very narrow type of math used for processing data. But AI is really about machines replacing people and being able to reason and make decisions on their own.
And so how did AI advance during the war on terror? Because if you look at it, we started collecting so much imagery that I used to joke with Nordy Schwartz about this, right? That at some point the Air Force was going to become the United States analytical force because you had so much imagery that you had to sift through. And then that's where the machine learning and elements of artificial intelligence came into being. What are the kinds of applications, whether in intelligence or other, right? I mean, is this sort of addressing the big data challenge of it? And what is the state of the art? Where are we now in the technology after working with it for some time as you have?
Yeah, sure. So I think prior to the terminology AI becoming prevalent, there used to be the big data term, right? The information overload. And really, you know, that was sort of the beginning of data science and data processing. Machine learning started to become more prevalent within the big data arena. Processors began to emerge specifically to accelerate big data processing problems in machine learning. So I wouldn't characterize it as AI based on the definition we just talked about, but it is the beginnings of some of the underpinnings for the data science and the machine learning. So it really originates anywhere you have a lot of data and a need to understand that data very fast.
What is the state of AI now in the United States and around the world, right? I mean, there's this tendency to think of our potential adversaries, right? China and Russia both have said that AI and data is the new oil, right? AI is a strategic goal. The Chinese are investing enormous sums of money in sort of a national AI enterprise. I wanted to get to a national model in a minute. But what is kind of the state of the art of what AI is able to do now? And where are we going to be, say, in 5 years, on where that state of the AI art is, and what will it mean then?
I think the best place to start for that is to look at some of the commercial applications, the commercial use cases. And then we can contrast those with perhaps some defense and national security applications. But, you know, like I said, you start with lots of data. So companies that were generating a lot of data, internet service providers and the like, to drive the state of practice, and in some cases, the state of the art for artificial intelligence. And I think the proliferation of unmanned systems, driverless vehicles, drones is the other side of the equation. So in commercial industry, you see a lot of sort of acceleration. And I like the driverless vehicle use case as an example, because it sort of takes in a lot of the processing problems, the decision-making, the reasoning, and then it implements the other side of the equation, the command and control, the automated control of physical and logical systems to either deliver something or deliver an effect or to move a physical system in some way. So that to me is an example of something that I would consider to be somewhat the state of a state of the art. There are other applications in medicine and elsewhere where, again, you're sort of back to machine learning based processing and decision-making and reasoning. But I think anywhere you see the coupling of the reasoning and the decision-making with the command and control of physical systems, that is pushing the state of the art, in my opinion.
As I mentioned, China and Russia are two nations that are taking sort of national approaches to AI. Whereas if you talk to most folks, even Pentagon leaders, you know, they'll say that we have a somewhat more nascent national approach to this. And that's in part because the United States has always seen private industry as the engine of innovation for these sorts of things that the government would then, and the government, including the Pentagon, would be able to piggyback on later. That's not necessarily the case. And this is going to sound like a somewhat self-serving opportunity for you, but it doesn't mean that it's not true about the differences about what commercial industry is doing and actually what the Pentagon and government needs are. Talk to us a little bit about sort of, you know, where the two intersect and what you can piggyback and goes in directly, and then what actually has to be remarkably tailored and is very different from what commercial industry is doing.
Yeah, sure. So I think this is an example where commercial industry is likely to lead the defense industry in terms of some of the underlying capabilities and applications, much like cloud computing, mobile computing was driven in commercial industry and adopted in the defense space. The same thing will occur here. I think within the U.S., our commercial enterprise is a great advantage. And we'll see a lot of acceleration of AI capabilities. And we mentioned a few commercial use cases just a short while ago. On the defense side, there's some very specific constraints that prevent our customers from being able to just take the commercial technology and use it as is. So our customers rarely have pervasive access to data. Often the data that they want to understand and reason on in a conflict will have never been seen before. So how do you develop a strategy that recognizes that and allows you to build systems where you may not have the full data sets that you're interested in? We don't have pervasive connectivity and networks. We have situations where an adversary might be trying to actively defeat our system, poison the data, or change the decision-making processes in the system through the data. So those sort of additional requirements are important. And I think that's one of the reasons why you're always going to need a tailored defense strategy that will leverage but be a little bit different than what you see in commercial industry.
What is the national AI strategy we need? Because this is a critical strategic enabler, right? It is applicable to almost anything, and to the point that it will enable individuals to control vast, vast numbers of systems, right? It's not autonomy as we have in certain systems now where a person is, you know, or two people control one flying vehicle. A person will be able to control thousands of flying vehicles or be able to analyze data at a scale and rate, and we'll get to computing and processing in a second. historically, the United States' great advantage has been that we can put people, visionary people in charge, backed with experts, given resources and authority, and we end up developing the atom bomb or advancing computing or develop the ICBM or the nuclear submarine. What's the kind of national approach we need when it comes to AI in terms of sort of helping oversee? Because, you know, some of the, there are policy questions that are associated with this. There are some funding questions associated with it. The kind of the questions even better than I do. I mean, is that the right approach? What is the right approach?
Yeah, so I'll speak to a defense strategy specifically, and not so much to commercial strategies. But, you know, if you think about some of the foundational items that will be needed for a defense strategy, I think it's important to start with the basics of the data. How do we create an environment where these AI-based systems can be developed, understood, trusted, evaluated, verified? We have a lot of physical test ranges. We have the ability to do certain types of analyses, but from a foundational point of view, I think the Defense Department needs to come up with something to fill the gap on our ability to simulate the environments and, you know, generate the synthetic data that's going to be needed to build AI systems of the future. So that to me is one of the most important foundational underpinnings of a strategy. I think,
What you're talking about are large scale, ultra realistic, synthetic training ranges, effectively.
Correct. Yes, I think that's mandatory, not only just to develop the technology, but, you know, understanding people learning to trust the system will be important. Obviously, we can't afford to go out and exercise every single scenario you might imagine in a physical environment. So being able to, you know, understand and trust intelligent systems in a synthetic environment is going to be very important. Exploring the ethics of AI within that environment and providing that feedback loop into the engineering, the designs, the solutions is very important. The people, the workforce, being able to hone their skills and tune their applications within that environment will be very important. So, you know, on the commercial side, you see a lot of companies initially building physical environments. You know, companies built fake cities, or they went into cities to experiment. But most of them are now building virtual environments because it's cost prohibitive and it's more efficient to work in the virtual environment.
Vern, you know, you mentioned ethics, and I know that people in the artificial intelligence game talk about it a lot. What is ethics in AI? Right. I mean, I know that the department built an ethics policy on it. I know a lot of people have been working on that over the years, and theoreticians have been talking about it. What does it mean?
Well, there are, you know, sort of ethical frameworks that have been published, again, by the Department of Defense. So I'll let the audience look those up. But largely, you know, we talked earlier about the machines being able to reason and make decisions. So a lot of the ethical framework is about ensuring that those decisions are ethical. Do they make sense? If a decision is going to be made, is it made in an ethical way? The data that's being used, is the data representative fully of the decision space that you want that machine to live in? And have we created, you know, the right environment for that machine to not only understand, but, you know, understand what an ethical decision is? So that's a lot of it. There are other elements, but again, I'll point the audience, they can search that up and read more about it.
The Joint Artificial Intelligence Center has been running for about 3 years. Jack Shanahan was the founding chief. Mike Rowan came aboard in October. They're working on artificial intelligence. Again, we're spearheading the policy and working on edge computing and networking. Edge computing is also one of those things that folks talk about but don't understand perhaps as clearly as they should. What is edge computing or computing at the edges?
edge computing is about processing the data where it's collected, right? So the environment I described earlier where we don't have strong connectivity, you can't depend on a link connecting you back into an enterprise data center. A platform will need to process, reason, decide on the data at the point of collection, or be able to distribute it across other local edge computing nodes so that they can reason on that together. So in the defense space, there's often significant size, weight, and power constraints, environmental considerations that lead to very unique processing electronics.
We are entering a quantum era, or we will be in a quantum era within about a decade. I think the Chinese posted a success just earlier this month. Google last year claims to have achieved quantum supremacy, and quantum supremacy, for folks who don't understand that, is solving a problem with a quantum computer, a supercooled quantum computer, in 200 seconds that would take a linear computer 10,000 years to solve, right? I mean, so Hartmut Nevin, who led the Google's team, has sort of likened it to, you know, if you have quantum, you're an alien dealing with cavemen with linear computers, just to put this in scale. I know that you work on these transformational computing and work and are very familiar with quantum. How does quantum change all of this?
Well, there's different aspects of quantum information science, and you know, understanding the differences and their relationship to distributed reasoning environment or AI is important. So there are quantum sensing applications, there are quantum communication technologies, there are a lot of innovations in the quantum field around timing, precise timing and navigation solutions. So those technologies can factor in where, for example, you may not have GPS. And AI and distributed decision making likes to know where things are and what time it is, right? So the more precise you can understand that, the more effective your AI and decision making will be. So quantum navigation, quantum timing will be important. The quantum computing space, I think, is a bit further out. It's a lot more complex. There are a lot of technologies that are emerging but aren't mature yet. There are a lot of companies making claims and talking about, you know, qubit volumes and processing, but I think we're a long way off until you see something useful there.
In part because, right, cooling requirements, but I mean, we also should acknowledge that, you know, on our wrists or in our pockets or supercomputers that would have taken, you know, entire buildings decades ago, right? I mean, we landed on the moon with 8K and, you know, the command module had, what, 16K, right? So
yeah,
it's, well, not like we can't get there.
No, I think we will get there eventually, but the, you know, processes and materials to fabricate and control qubits is not mature yet.
Right.
Is maturing, and there are different capabilities out there, but it's a long way off.
Admiral Mike Rogers, the former director of the National Security Agency and the commander of U.S. Cyber Command, you know, discussed that we will have legacy platforms for a long time. You know, the question is how to improve those platforms. Do we have the right policies and acquisition approaches in place to be able to apply AI to a lot of platforms and systems that actually were never designed to have AI in them in the first instance, right? I mean, that's going to drive computing needs, right? I mean, back to your space, weight, power. For some things, it won't matter. For other things, it may matter. Are we thinking the way that we need to be thinking in order to be able to take full advantage of the kind of capability that we're going to be rolling out?
Yeah, I don't think it's as straightforward as we'd like it to be, because, you know, the legacy platforms will be around for a while. Most of them were designed with people in the middle of the conops, people making decisions, people controlling things. And it's not straightforward to do that on a lot of legacy platforms. There's simple things you can do, like use machine learning to classify objects in a data stream, and a lot of platform customers are doing that now. But, you know, how do I incorporate intelligent technology in a legacy system that is really designed around people is not an easy question to answer. In parallel, we'll want to be building intelligent automated systems. So things that are a little bit more greenfield, you know, from the ground up, the ConOp has some more flexibility. And so you can implement the technology differently in a system like that. And then the third piece is, how do I get those things to function together? How do I take a system that is largely human-based and get it to work with systems that are largely machine-based, and overcome the ConOps, the training, the doctrine that gets put into all of our warfighters on how to use the systems? So it's a very complex problem. It's not just a technology problem.
You know, earlier in the podcast, you mentioned sort of getting rid of people, right? What are the kinds of people we get rid of, right? I mean, is it the dull, dirty, dangerous sort of thing, right? I mean, we're not getting rid of all people. In fact, we want to use this as an exponential force multiplier in many respects, right? So it's about getting rid of people. It's about using people very differently. What do you mean by that for some people who may not fully understand what you're trying to do, right? I mean, so that they don't go full Luddite, you know, break the machine, it will make us, you know, that's which is not what you're talking about. Well, it may be elsewhere, but in a military context, you mean something very specific.
That's right. And just to be clear, I'm not talking about removing all people. That is not what I am saying.
You mean it's not going to be Skynet, you know, ultimately?
No, I don't think so. But, you know, there are certain environments, for example, long endurance, denied environments, very high, you know, information overload environments, where it's just not practical to have people looking at processing, trying to reason on massive volumes of information for really long periods of time, right? So that there's an example on the reasoning side where you really want to leverage the benefit of the machines. And then on the other side, on the command and control side, some of the controls have to be implemented so fast that you really don't have time to stick a person in the middle of the decision loop. All right, so maneuvering, swarm control, things like that are not practical to have a human in the middle of it. So those are just some examples. You're still going to have people overseeing these systems and controlling how they operate, keeping them safe. But, you know, some of the functions in the systems will need to be replaced with machines.
Let me take you to the skill set and the people issue and the partnership and collaboration piece of the equation. Is the nation producing the kind of talent it needs to satisfy demand, right? I mean, you guys are always, there is a massive drive for kind of highly skilled cyber and information talent, artificial intelligence, right? I mean, these are all very, very hot markets. And what's the role of partnerships? You guys have partnered with Carnegie Mellon, one of the world's preeminent scientific institutions, as well as smaller companies, right? Parts of the government. I mean, they're, you know, the AFWERX team. I mean, everybody is kind of working on making these kind of innovative partnerships at the end of the day. Talk to us about the supply of talent out there and what are you guys doing to access it? And on the flip side, what are these partnerships bringing you that you're not able to deliver on your own?
Sure. So from a talent point of view, it's important to remember that AI isn't one thing. It's many different types of competencies and skills. And so underneath of AI, you have mathematicians, you have data scientists, you have software engineers, you have database engineers, you have electronics experts. And, you know, a way to come at the talent and the skills is by, you know, repurposing people that are working in other fields, creating the environment in which they can work on AI and having them do that. And so it isn't one thing. It's a combination of competencies and skills. And a lot of the engineering schools are already producing those competencies. They aren't always applied into the use cases that we're interested in. And so that's where, you know, you got to take those underlying skills and then start using them. With respect to partners, you know, we have a lot of expertise in the defense space. We understand our customers' problems, but the pace of innovation on the commercial side is going to be very fast. They'll be building a lot of technologies. And as I said earlier, those technologies probably won't drop right into our customers' requirements and solve their problem. So it's important that we know how to identify those compelling technologies. We work with those partners to get them tailored and applied into the systems that our customers are going to need.
And what are the kind of partnerships you guys are going to be looking to strike in the future? I mean, do you have a roadmap for this as you, you know, based on what you achieved in 20, what you want to see in 21 and beyond?
Yeah, we have a combination of, you know, we have an academic approach. We have small, medium, and large businesses that we work with. We usually frame problems to those partners, examples of things that we think our customers will need to deal with. And we'll allow those partners to work together to help us solve the overall system problem. So we have an approach with different types of partners, and then we have a, you know, a problem and an application-based approach to understand what the technologies are and how we can use them.
Before we go, what we're talking about is so fundamentally game-changing, right? We've talked about this before, but it changes everything. And automated cars, more electric cars, changes the need for, you may not need as many truck drivers, you may not need as many mechanics, right? I mean, the whole infrastructure of how we live our lives, and indeed because of COVID, it's changed a lot about how we're already living our lives that may be more permanent than not. How do we need to think about this AI future that's actually approaching much faster in many respects than organizations, right? How do organizations and the military in particular need to think about this future well before it arrives to not be surprised by this future when it arrives?
Yeah, well, you know, in the commercial space, as you said, your mind can wander, and the byproducts of AI and autonomous systems are interesting, like the ones you mentioned. From a defense point of view, I think, and from a strategy point of view, it's important to understand the technology is coming. It'll be available. And then, you know, the evaluation of that technology in context of a threat, the evaluation of that technology in context of a transformational capability for our own purposes is sort of ways to think about the purpose of a strategy and what is it we're trying to do from a threat mitigation and a, you know, transformational point of view. So I think, as you said earlier, it's nascent right now. There are a lot of possibilities, and you know, I look forward to talking with you more about it.
Vern, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you and yours have very, very happy holidays, and looking forward to having you back on again next year.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation, and I look forward to talking to you more in the future.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.